Good morning, folks. Welcome to Peaks Podcast. This is your host, Brad Foreman, and this is Season 5, I can't believe it, Episode 65. As you'll recall, Season 5 is all about Karsten's Pyramid Peak, the four-year journey training for this objective. It's been closed for up to almost 4 years. But we hear some good news that it might be opening up in the next couple months. So, I'm remaining optimistic. I'm up here in Colorado training at 10,000 feet. Perfect place to stay acclimated. I want to thank the listeners from, you guys out there listening to peakspodcast.rocks. You're really making a difference. We have over 4,000 views, which for a little guy like me is quite rewarding. We have also a link for our non-profit charity, Foreman 7 Project, which you can find at my peakspodcast.rocks site. What we're doing is we're raising money for kids at risk. So 100% of any funds that you give to that charity goes to kids at risk. The whole reason we started this podcast is to encourage people to get outdoors and enjoy the wilderness. And so far, I'm hearing positive things people are getting out there. It's a good thing to start, a great habit to start. Okay, what are we going to do today? Well, I'm super psyched. We have a special guest that I've known for years. He's a legendary climber. As a matter of fact, he's the first Argentinian to summit Everest in the year 1995. And how did I get to know him? This fellow named Tommy Hendricks was one of the lead guides on my expedition 17 years ago when we climbed the highest peak in South America named Aconcagua. A lot of people believe Aconcagua is one of the top three toughest of the summits. So it was a great accomplishment. Tommy, as our guide, one of our lead guides, was in charge of photography. He's a world-famous photographer and has just a super interesting background. He is now in between expeditions down in South America. So I'm going to try to reach him, plug him into this podcast, and we'll continue on. Thanks for your support of peakspodcast.rocks, and we'll be back momentarily with our special guest. Hello, Tommy. Welcome to Peaks Podcast. How are you doing, my old friend?
Doing great. How are you?
Fantastic. Now, what part of the world are you in, Tommy?
I am now in Buenos Aires, Argentina. How are you doing?
Fantastic. Just got back from a training. Sorry, I'm a little late to kick off this podcast. But what an honor it is to have Argentinian superstar Tommy Hendricks on Peaks Podcast.
It's a pleasure. We became great friends, and that I really, really appreciate and value greatly. So,
well,
the least I can do.
I was going through some timelines, and I thought maybe it'd be fun to start out back in 1995. Can you tell me what was your inspiration to be the first Argentinian to summit Everest?
It wasn't so much at first about becoming the first person from Argentina to do it. It was the drive and my interest, personal interest in going to the summit of Mount Everest and climbing as a profession. But it was quite difficult at home with my family's pressure just to dedicate myself to climbing as a profession itself. I am an agricultural engineer, and perhaps in the family during those days, or even in the 80s when I was doing university studying and began climbing, very odd and not accepted within my family environment to dedicate oneself to sports or something as non-traditional like it was climbing. So what I felt is that in the first place, I really wanted to climb Mount Everest. And I had already been climbing for many years, since 1982, 81. And I felt that I wasn't taken seriously. So climbing Everest to me felt that it was the way to certainly commit myself to professionally pursuing climbing. Now, months before leaving for Everest, I heard through a friend of mine that there had not been any person from Argentina who had been to the summit of Everest. And that certainly gave it an additional impulse or interest as for me to reach the summit. And I felt that there was no time to waste and go ahead and do it back in 1994 at first, and 1995 for certain, which is when I was basically able to go. Weeks before departing for Nepal in 94, which I was going to do with Scott Fisher and Brent Bishop from the United States, I injured my left knee while working in a ski resort in Park City, which I lived at the time. So I had to postpone going on that expedition with both of them and go to surgery. I had ACL, MCL surgery, and then I was on crutches for about 6 months or so, and recovering, doing rehab. And within 10 months of the accident, I was basically reaching the summit of Mount Everest. I basically took the chance of, or not the chance, I always felt I was really bad at just raising funds and looking at the financial aspect of things. I was always passionate about climbing and very, very bad and poor at getting the money to do that. So it was a very good learning experience for me to have to be sort of in the bed or going to the hospital and not able to work out beyond the rehab, as for me to go and focus on getting the money to go to Everest in 95, which in the end happened. And I don't know, I was able to go on an expedition with a group of friends from the United States who I didn't know until we arrived in Kathmandu. And that was a big challenge to a certain degree, but I was fully committed to climbing the mountain. And I felt that there was no obstacle that I would not be able to overcome at the time to reach the summit. I was willing to give everything, my life included, in order to reach the summit of Everest. So I was so committed, especially after losing the chance in 94.
Golly, that's quite a story. So how many people were on your team in total in 95?
They were nine people originally, and I was the 10th person. Now, there was another issue that happened, and it's that the government of Nepal was issuing only one permit per season and with a maximum of seven people. So what happened was there was an exception to that rule when you could prove that you were doing some sort of environmental work, because Everest until then was extremely dirty. Until 1994, which is when Brent Bishop and Scott Fisher started what was called the Sagarmatha Environmental Expedition, and then the pollution control, Sagarmatha pollution control, where they were basically doing what is called a buyback system, where you pay Sherpa who are going up the mountain with their loads that they're carrying, money in order for them to come down. Instead of empty in their backpacks, they would come down with garbage, oxygen bottles at the time. And we were paying them a certain amount of money for every oxygen bottle or for the number of kilograms that they were bringing down. We continued with that, but then Rob Hall was also with a commercial expedition on the mountain. And we ended up purchasing the three remaining permits from Rob Hall, who had actually two permits, because he was taking a few other clients, not just seven, among clients and guided people. So I ended up being on Rob Hall's permit, but climbing with another expedition.
That's what's
And
happening. That's pretty interesting. You got to be a flexible in Nepal, right?
was, I would say, perhaps even harder than climbing the mountain itself, because even getting to it was very difficult. In 94, there was a waiting list for people to climb Mount Everest of about 8 years. And that's when I had to kind of start looking for people who already had the permit to climb the mountain, or expeditions who had the permit. And in 95, there were two options. This one, which was called the Americans on Everest Expedition, and an expedition from the north side, which was a commercial expedition. And I just never liked the concept of commercial climbing, or I never felt I needed any guides to climb the mountain. If anything, I could easily be a guide myself. I had already been climbing for 10, 15 years, and I had done quite a few extreme and difficult climbs. So I was very prepared technically. And I had already climbed Aconcagua solo. I had climbed Xolaitze, which is a small mountain, or 22,000 foot peak mountain near Mount Everest, also solo, very technical. I had been on Yosemite for many months, climbing big walls on El Capitan, on Half Dome, and I had done several routes also unroped. And climbing Everest was a big challenge, but I was very, very committed to climbing it with a group of people, not just by myself. I really wanted to reach the summit and felt that I had greater chances to do it with somebody by my side. So when I talked to these guys on their commercial expedition on the Chinese side, Anatoly Bukrev was among those, I felt that it didn't make much sense. When after talking with those guys who were going on the south side, what I really felt attracted to is that the first thing that they said is they looked at my resume and they said, "Well, we really like the way you're climbing and your profile, but we do not like the fact of you doing solo climbs, and we do not want you to break loose on your own." And I immediately said, "This is what I want. This is an expedition that is really appealing." What they also told me is, to us, climbing to the summit is very important, but it is far more important that we enjoy ourselves and climb as a group of friends. And that's when I said, "Boom, this is the expedition. This is what I really want to do with them. Climb with a group of people in the way I used to do in the 80s, where it wasn't so much about reaching the summit, but about enjoying what you were doing, having fun and climbing with people that I don't know, that I felt I had a common goal with."
Well, the one thing I've always learned about or loved about climbing is the camaraderie. Just what you're saying. You can be so close with so many different people that you never have a chance to befriend if you weren't on a mountain, risking your life, right?
I agree. And the one thing that was so appealing too is that we became immediately very close friends. And what I felt is, and I talk about this every time I go to the mountains, is that the first thing I say is, just don't risk your life to go and rescue me in case I am not back after 2 or 3 days. Or if you see that I am very far and in a place that is exposed to get to, just leave me there. But at the same time, I make it very clear that I am willing to give everything from my part to help my teammates and to rescue them. And I had no doubts about doing that when being on Everest. There was a point where we did a first attempt on May 5th, and weather was really bad. There were a lot of avalanches. We had to split the team in two because we were 20 people when you considered the Sherpa too that were part of our team. They were not there just to carry our loads. We were carrying loads as much as they were doing back in on that expedition. There were people helping us out. There were climbers like we were, like Apa Sherpa was one of those, but he was actually the Sirdar and leading the Sherpa group. And Apa and I just climbed together as teammates, very much like Edmund Hillary and Tenzing Norgay did back in 1953. It wasn't just about telling him, okay, you carry my loads, you carry my rope, fix everything, and we'll come right after you. We were sharing the tents. We were just, I don't know, doing everything together. And even when we went towards the summit, we were only 5 people all together. 3 Sherpa, Brad Bull, myself, Apa Sherpa, his brother, Arita Sherpa, and then Kamirita Sherpa, another Sherpa from Tame. And we were always alternating the lead so that none of us would get exhausted, and in the important aspect, so that we would be able to climb quickly and safely towards the summit. And that's how we reached the top in less than 8 hours from the south col up to the top itself. We moved very quickly, but very efficiently among anything else.
Are you guys using oxygen?
We did on the last day. I was committed to climbing without oxygen, but the week before reaching the top, I ended up going out to help a couple of my teammates who were stranded below Camp 4, and I left all of my warm clothes, and I just went without a harness, thinking that they were really close by. And it took me like 10 minutes to get to them, but it took me an hour and a half to get to the camp with the first person, and then another half an hour to get back to the camp with the second person. And by then I was already with some serious frostbite in my hands, and especially my toes and my nose. So when we reached base camp, and we had to decide who was ready to go back up to do a second summit attempt, the whole team itself said, if you want to go to the summit, we want you to secure the top. So you have to use oxygen, because there's no way you will reach the summit with this kind of frostbite already. So I ended up using oxygen from Camp 4 up, which I struggled a lot with. But at the same time, under my point of view, I had to, like you said, adjust to my team's request. And basically, I don't know, I had to be a team member. I couldn't just go and do my own thing, which is what I had committed myself to.
That was very That was very good.
And then at the time, I had gotten in debt with about $30,000 in order to get to Mount Everest and be able to climb. So at that point, returning home without reaching the summit would have meant that I would have had no chances of getting that money back. So reaching the summit with or without oxygen is what mattered also. And it definitely proved to be the right thing from an economical standpoint. I was able to recover the money and pay everything back within 3 years. But it was because of starting to do speaking engagements and then all what came from successfully reaching the summit. Those were different times than what we live today, basically. Everest was still a summit that not many people had reached. As a matter of fact, I was the person number 601 in the world to do that. I was the first person in Argentina to reach the summit as well. But I don't know, when I came back and I sat down to talk with the different sponsors, they considered it was quite a feat, as opposed to today where, I don't know, there's so many people who have climbed Mount Everest that it's no longer special, if you want to call it that way, special to everybody's eyes. I think it is still special from an individual standpoint. I think that it's still very difficult and it takes a lot of commitment to reach the summit of Mount Everest, but it's become so popular that I think there's somehow, I don't know, it's been minimized, so to speak, as an achievement.
Yeah, I think you're right. It is, you know, it was so popularized by the Summit and Summit book. And since then, correct, you know, it's been on the bucket list for a lot of people. Hey, well,
what?
That was an absolutely wonderful accomplishment. You have so many, I don't want to leave out any of these. So you went to the North Pole, huh? Is that correct?
Yes, I went. I was hired to photograph and film an expedition from Argentina in 2016. I've been, ever since I began climbing, or even before that, I was always photographing. And I could never see myself going out on expeditions and climbing without my camera in hand. And my other goal was to always be able to work with National Geographic, and I achieved that as well. But then what I liked was the combination of climbing mountains with documenting, filming, and photographing, which is what I was able to achieve basically as of 1995, 96. I did a couple assignments with National Geographic in 2006 and 2011. And then I was consistently hired to photograph and film different expeditions back in 1998, 1997 also to Pakistan, a couple 8,000ers. And then the North Pole, it was quite surprising how it happened. Basically, I was photographing polo tournaments here in Argentina, and the president of the Argentine Polo Association, he was he is a general from Argentina's army, and he just approached me and said, hey, we're planning an expedition within another year or so, and we would like you to come and photograph and film this for us. So at first I said no on many occasions, because my wife, Victoria, was at the time with battling cancer. She had been diagnosed in 2012 with colon cancer. So that's when I basically started not going on expeditions to the Himalayas and focused more on the family. And in 2016, she was undergoing chemotherapy and many surgeries. So I felt that I would have exposed myself too much, which I couldn't do. And then the other thing was the risk. Now, right at the time, Victoria went through a couple of months of feeling well, and she just basically kicked my ass and said, you've got to go, because I was becoming a pain in the ass, I would say.
I can see that.
Sorry?
I can see that.
I can see that myself too. You know, it's like, to be honest, I feel so out of my environment while living here in Buenos Aires, which is a big city, flat, next to the ocean, away from the mountains. it's so difficult to live in a place like this. And it took a lot of effort. I don't know if effort is the right word, but when Victoria and I met and decided to stay in Buenos Aires, it was very difficult to come and be based out of a city like Buenos Aires and keep climbing and form a family. But then when shit hit the fan with her cancer, I had no doubt of what I had to do, which didn't mean that it was still difficult for me not to go climbing. I was really happy, and I'm really proud of being at home when I had to do it. At the same time, I keep missing going out to the mountains and climbing. It's something that I love and I am passionate about. And especially when it comes to photographing and filming, it isn't just about reaching the summit, which I started climbing. It was, like you said, getting to know really great people, wonderful friends. Oftentimes, and perhaps too many of them have died, but the one thing that I always understood is that it was through climbing that I was able to meet many of these people who got killed on the mountains also. So it is a constant battle. Now, I don't know, it is in the mountains that I've learned to be a better person as well. And that was perhaps the ultimate goal, enjoying life and becoming a better person. So when it came to making a decision whether to look after my family or to keep climbing, I had no doubt about it. I had fulfilled many of my dreams. I had climbed so many mountains, and had, I don't know, to a great extent, succeeded in being able to climb and look after my family, which is something that I really wanted to do. And I had also been able to work with National Geographic, or being hired to photograph and film expeditions like the one where you and I met on Aconcagua in 2005.
That was a great time.
It was a beautiful expedition. And that's exactly what makes them worthwhile. You know, I don't know what's, I don't mind commercial expeditions, but I think what I do not like oftentimes in the commercial expedition environment, or even in the mountains itself, is that there's like a competition, or it doesn't matter how you reach the summit oftentimes. And that to me is the difference between back in the 80s and what you see today. It's like there's a race, oftentimes big egos that are tinting what you mentioned, you know, where you just go and climb because on goal. And yes, you can compete, but I think that the greatest competition is within oneself and not against a mountain or against somebody else. If anything, I think it is so important to become partners with those who you share the mountain with, and basically listen to the mountain where you are not conquering it, but basically climbing with it, with its permission, like they say in Nepal, where you're basically, I don't know, we listen to the mountain by paying attention to avalanches, to bad weather conditions, where you're saying, this is not the right time to go to the top. Maybe it's better to turn back and go home, you know? And it should not be an issue at all to turn back if you are conscious about it, if your goals are properly set up. And I've seen far too many people who just show their worst part of the person while they are on expeditions, just focused on reaching the summit blindly, you know, where they don't care if they risk uselessly their lives, or they are not well prepared and believe that somebody else is going to take them to the top. I think that in order to climb a mountain, guided or unguided, you need to be prepared. so that you do not put at risk other people who have prepared themselves, and so that you're ready and prepared to reach the summit for yourself in the first place. And I believe that fair means is a very ample term. To me, it's fair means based on how you can perform. If you need a guide, perfect, great, but just do it in a humble way, just by listening to the mountain and by listening to the people that you have come to, I don't know, ask for help and assistance in order to reach your goal. You know, I think it's so important to do that. And
I don't agree. When I first realized you were a hero on our Aconcagua trip, what was it? It was 2005, I believe. And yeah, it was the first time I met you, and you were with our Colorado climbing group, and we were all having fun. And then started getting a little bit more serious once we got up to high camp. And of course, we had the elite team as our guides. Tommy, obviously, you were one of them, along with Ben and Lawan. Well, there was an emergency on the mountain the night we were supposed to leave for the summit.
Correct. But
instead of us summiting, you guys had to make the painful choice to go out in the middle of the night and rescue these
Correct.
Group that was not prepared like us, and risk your lives and possibly risk our summit. But of course, that was the right choice and the less selfish choice. You guys saved them, and thank God we were able to summit the next day. But I will never forget that heroism, truly, that you guys exhibited.
I don't know if it's, I do not see myself as a hero. I'm just a climber. And what it happened in 95 and perhaps on many other expeditions or climbs that I've been on. And I don't think I could live with myself if I had not gone out to help somebody and rescue that person when I was able to do it. What would piss the hell out of me is just to find out that this person should not be there. And especially when I am committed to a group like yours in 2005, where you guys had worked your ass off to get there. And you were as strong as we were, you know, Charlie was, or Chris was, everybody was. And I don't think it is fair from that point of view, but it doesn't mean that I should not, I don't know, it's a battle. It's a constant battle, because I don't
That's
like to
one.
See somebody die, but at the same time, I am there to help you guys, and you guys did everything right to go and climb the mountain and reach the summit. And it is not fair for you guys also to see somebody like, in that case, Lawang and myself, go out and tell you hours later, hey, we need to rest because we haven't been able to sleep or whatever. You have all the right to say, hey, well, why should we risk our summit, you know? And that ended up being that case where those who were up there were not supposed to be up there at that time of the day. So it was quite upsetting also, on the other hand. And the good thing is that we had the time and we had planned on having more extra days to go and do another push or delay our summit attempt a little bit. So
it was a good plan, no doubt about it.
Correct. But then there are many people who do not have that option, you know, or even there are people who get killed trying to help somebody else. And oftentimes you will hear others criticizing people for not going out and helping somebody who's in need of being helped. And it's very easy to criticize, but it's very, 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 very hard to do that. You cannot always go out and help somebody or even bring somebody down alive, you know, even no matter how hard you work on it. So, I don't know, it's a tricky thing. And that was also a reason for which I somehow focused on climbing and filming and photographing instead of guiding. It was easy for me to become a guide, and I just rejected the idea of doing so. I basically do go out on very, very few trips as a guide. I'm very selective. And that's why I also chose you guys. It wasn't just you choosing me, but I also chose you guys. But then after 2005, I focused more on expeditions that I felt were worthwhile, either filming or photographing. And that's when 2006 came with the Polish expedition to Nanga Parbat during the winter time. It was really extreme and under really, really extreme conditions. We were facing minus 80, I don't know, just winds that were howling at 160 miles an hour, and exposing ourselves to an environment that was really hostile, but it was a beautiful expedition. And again, because of the camaraderie, the way we were committed to climbing the mountain, and it was very clear from the get-go that we were not willing to kill any of our team members because of reaching the summit. And we ended up turning back without succeeding. And at first, National Geographic killed the story by saying, there's no summit, there's no reason to publish this story, until they started looking at the photograph or the photographs that I brought back, and then reading the article that was being written for the magazine. And they said, there's so much more into this than just or reaching a summit. So they ended up publishing the article in 2008. And it was, I don't know, beautiful to just be able to pursue my goals beyond just climbing mountains. It was just doing it for fun, and then also dedicating my time to the family, without just being away all the time, just guiding, so to speak, which is what I didn't want to do. I wanted to just be on expeditions. The drawback is that they were often very extreme and dangerous, but they were worthwhile expeditions for me. And the same thing happened in 2011 when I went to K2 with Gerlinde Kaltenbrunner, where I was documenting her with her final 8,000er, which became the first woman to reach the summit of all 14 8,000 meter mountains without the use of supplemental oxygen. And it was a beautiful expedition, a team of only six people. We climbed K2 from the north side without any porters or oxygen. It was just the six of us on the mountain during the entire season and the entire climb. Well, on the Pakistani side or the south side of K2, there were 12 expeditions, there were porters and everything. And we ended up putting four of us, team members, on the summit. And three of them completed the 8,000ers, all of them without oxygen on that expedition. Unfortunately, I turned basically on our summit push, because I don't know, I had been buried under three avalanches and something didn't feel right after that. What I did is I called with a sat phone to Liam, who at the time was only 6 years old, my son. And
I know Liam.
Yeah, great kid, great guy.
He's quite a but young man.
I knew that by listening to his voice, I would make the hard decision to just say, boom, there's a different priority. And that's something that one of my teammates, Matsutsumaye, told me when he came down from reaching the summit. You know, it's like he looked at me and said, I forgot about my family. I forgot about my sons, about my wife. I focus on the summit, and you didn't. That's why you didn't reach the summit. And he was right. He was true. But what I also thought about is that my goal at the time was not just to reach the summit of K2. It was to photograph for National Geographic. And I was, there was kind of a battle also, because within me, so to speak, this battle where I remained, or I returned to base camp, and I got some of the best photos that I ever got later on by photographing my teammates on the summit during the evening time. And you can see in one of these photos that was published in the magazine, their headlamp, just a little speck of light reflected on the slopes of K2. And it's a beautiful image. But now I always felt that it would be very, very, very difficult to find a team as good and as strong as the one we had back in that expedition in 2011. Among the six of us, we had been to close to 200 expeditions to the 8,000ers, and we had more than 80 summits of 8,000ers, and it was huge. A very, very experienced and professional team of climbers. And above all, the unique aspect of this expedition is that we got along beautifully throughout the entire trip. We had a couple arguments, but they were minimal. I don't know. And it had to do with the fact that I was kind of unroping in order to take better photographs somehow. I was breaking some of the things we had talked about when it came to safety. And to me, I had to risk a little more in order to get better pictures for National Geographic. And I don't know, it felt pretty bad to become sort of the rotten apple in the box, if you want to call it that way, when entering a conflict like that. But it was so, so important for me to come home, if possible, with both things, the summit and the photos for National Geographic. But when I had to choose, I had no doubt what to choose. It was Liam and Victoria in the first place, but then also coming down with great photos for National Geographic and not getting killed.
That's very important. The last one, yeah. All of them.
Well, you know, I love climbing and I love life. I'm passionate about both things, and I'm not afraid of getting killed, but I would be so pissed off if I got killed on a mountain, because I think it is a place where I enjoy being and living, and it fulfills many of my dreams and my ambitions when I am in a city like Buenos Aires or becoming a family man. And it would be stupid to get killed there. You know, I was so upset when the Latin American version of National Geographic published the article in 2008 and called it suicidal expedition, because we're not there to commit suicide. We're there to enjoy life and to live life. And we know, at least I do, and most of the people that I have climbed with, we know perfectly well that in order to achieve your dreams and your goals, you have to risk things. You will never achieve a summit if you're just dreaming of climbing a mountain, but you do not get out of your bed or your couch. You have to move up. You have to get out of your comfort zone. And not just one day, but oftentimes every single day. And as you're getting closer to the summit, this is even harder and harder, because you encounter just, I don't know, howling winds and temperatures that are ridiculous. You're throwing up, you have a headache, and it's like you're many times saying, damn it, what the hell am I doing here? But if you know why you're doing it, you will achieve those things. And to me, it's, like I said, not just to reach the summit of a mountain, it's just to enjoy life, to live life, to love life. And then as a part of it too, it's just to become friends with people like you and so many others, you know, that we have been with on the mountains. And these are the people that enrich our lives also, beyond, I don't know, fortunately, those that we call our wives or our sons and brothers, you know.
Tommy, that's a great segue into the lighter side of the conversation. Was, or is, after what, 17 years, we end up meeting and hiking on the other side of the world, right, over in the fjords of Norway just 2 months ago. And I was able to meet your son, Liam, and it wasn't that just kind of magical, you know, after so many years? It felt like I saw you yesterday.
Mm-hmm. Correct. And it felt the same for me when meeting you and everyone else, you know. I was so excited about being there. And it was just by chance that we coincided in being in Norway at the same time. And I just didn't want to miss the opportunity. And having Liam with me was just, I don't know, he was only 1 year old when we were on Aconcagua together. So just introducing Liam to you guys, to me, was so important. And doing it in an environment that is just, I don't know, something that we all love and are passionate about, you know, like climbing and hiking or being out in the open in nature. And that's what I would really like to share with Liam, you know, that to the point where I don't care if he climbs or not. That's something that he has to do if he likes. But I think he would know me from a different standpoint if he was able to see me out there, you know, where I'm not this grumpy or accelerated guy who's running around trying to pay bills and making money. I'm just a person who's out there climbing and with a big smile that I can't stop having because I'm in, I don't know, in nature. Unfortunately, we have to do other things that we do not like in order to continue doing what we do love. So, I don't know.
There's always a trade-off, no doubt about it.
Well, and it's better to do what you love in order to achieve what you want to do, you know, because when it gets hard to face this trade-off that you're talking about, it's easier because you're doing something that you love. I don't know. Yep. That's what I keep telling Liam. You know, I don't want him to do a job that he doesn't like. On the contrary, I want him to enjoy it. He's now 18 years old and about to start studying in college and stuff. And I'm in no way interested in putting pressure on him to do something that he doesn't like. But yeah, I do want him to be prepared for life itself.
Oh, you've done a great job with him. He'll make the right, he'll make good choices, I believe.
Oh, I'm sure about it. I hope so. And he's a nice guy. He's a great guy. I'm really proud of him, actually. So it's...
Hey, Tommy, people that listen to my podcast often want to reach out and, you know, secure services if possible, or maybe do photo shoots. How would somebody get a hold of you if you're even interested in you know, another expedition or something of that nature?
Let's see. I'm very bad with my website, but I've only posted 3 or 4 photos, and it says working on it. But the website is tommyheinrich.org or tommyheinrich.com. T is in Tom, OMMYHEINRICH.org. That's my email.
I'll post that also on my podcast so they can just click and go.
Appreciate that.
Yeah, I really appreciate that. I can't tell you how much this means to me. It kind of completes a full 2-decade circle. And I know you've been super busy. I know you, you know, have all kinds of accolades and work that you're still working on. And I just appreciate your time and sharing your thoughts. I think it's inspirational as anything.
To me, it's, I don't know when you mentioned this, but we were talking for a few days, and there was no doubt in my mind I would love to do this with you. It's great, and I really appreciate it. I really appreciate you asking me to be part of this. And I don't know, you're a beautiful friend to me, so it's great to have met you, and I'm sure hoping that we'll have a few more decades to go.
I hope so. I want you to meet my kids too. We'll have some fun.
We will do that. We'll definitely do that.
Okay, Tommy. Thanks for your time, and have a great day.
You too.
This is Peaks Podcast signing off. Have a great day, and thanks for listening today. Bye bye.
Bye bye.